Daniel chapter 10, verse 20. Hear the word of the Lord. So he said, "Do you know why I have come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go, the prince of Greece will come. But first I will tell you what is written in the book of truth. No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him. Now then, I will tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth, who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. And then a mighty king will appear, who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. And after he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others." And then jumping ahead to verse 43. "He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver, and all the riches of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." This is the word of the Lord. My daughter confirmed this weekend that it really is the case that one of our favorite family videos in our very limited video library is Back to the Future Part 2. I don't know how many of you have seen it, but you who have not may need to be helped to catch this illustration. The film concerns one hero by the name of Marty McFly, who travels into the future and unfortunately makes the mistake of buying a sports almanac that has all the scores for games played from 1950 to 2000. And then he brings it back into the past in order to enjoy it for pleasure reading. Doc Brown sees the almanac and goes ballistic. He warns Marty that he's in danger of rupturing the space-time continuum with this knowledge if he would act on it, and how dangerous the almanac is, and so they toss it away. Unknown to both Doc and Marty, Bill Tannen, the bully from the original film, is overhearing this interesting bit of news. And sure enough, the next time Marty McFly travels into the future and returns to 1985, the past has been unalterably changed. Now, the nemesis Biff is a multi-billionaire, having invested very wisely in the sports area. He also not only is running the town, but happens to have married Marty McFly's mother, which is rather disconcerting, and the film goes on from there. In some ways, our text this morning could be compared to that sports almanac and the apparent trouble and difficulties that it poses for us as we imagine such detailed predictions, tomorrow's news available to an earlier generation and to the generations that would follow Daniel. On almost any interpretation, Daniel chapter 11 encompasses a span of about 375 years. On some views, it would go even longer. And if you include chapter 12, well, my goodness, it ends with the resurrection. So a vast stretch of time. And in chapter 11, in the portion that we haven't read, and a portion that I'll admit the first time I read seemed terribly tedious, perhaps like a sports almanac, particularly one that features a lot of minor league players. You might wonder, what's all this about? Why is it in here? And why is it necessary to be revealing this to Daniel, living in 539 BC, about events be hundreds of years later? And is it wise to put this kind of sensitive information into the hands of those earlier generations of God's people? What's the lesson? Well, if you actually look in detail in Daniel 11, you'll realize that the predictions are not so specific that it has tremendous commercial use for a wise investor or a sports bettor or whatever. But it does have vital spiritual use. And so one of our intentions will first be to go through this chapter, or not all of it. We unfortunately will leave for next week the juiciest parts at the end. But to look through it and then consider what are the applications for that generation, but especially for ourselves. Chapters 11 and 12, and that's the reason I read those opening verses of chapter 12, as I say, cover a span of time that starts with the message of the angel, Gabriel, we assume, to Daniel at his time, 539 BC, and talks about the course of human events stretching out into the distant future, and if you include chapter 12, right to the resurrection. Obviously, these two chapters cannot include an exhaustive account of all the history of all the nations of the world. It is rather a very selective summary of history, even though it involves lots of detail. A selective summary that is restricted first and foremost, of course, just to the interests of the people of God. The angel emphasizes this in chapter 10, verse 14. Now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people, not to the folks in Venezuela or somewhere in Japan or wherever. It's just the people of God, and in this time in the economy of God, predominantly Israel, of course. Now I've come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the future, for the vision concerns a time yet to come. Furthermore, it's not even all the things that happened to Israel in this span of time. Rather, the chapter is restricted to just the bad news. Just bad news. You see, Daniel had been one of those deportees, one of the captives of King Nebuchadnezzar, the ruthless and great king that forged the Babylonian Empire, brought from his homeland of Jerusalem and forced to live out his life in distant Babylon to the east. Daniel had been told, and from his reading of Jeremiah confirmed, that at the end of this 70-year period of captivity, God's people would be permitted to return to the promised land. And naturally, he's hoping that means a return to freedom, liberty, to serve God, enjoy him forever. But in fact, it was the burden of Daniel's message to say that, yes, we will no longer be forced to live out in captivity, but we will be back in the land, this time experiencing a kind of adversity that is a captivity within our own community, because we will be under the thumb of foreign powers dominating us. The suffering that will continue will not be the suffering that is apportioned for our sins, as was the captivity. Not all adversity is punishment. God allows his people, nevertheless, to go through times of trial, and that's what's recorded in chapter 11, to prepare the people of God. This much bad news needs lots of help for us to assimilate it. This is why it's so necessary to have the resounding comfort that you get in chapter 10, that you're not in this alone. That in the unseen realm, in the heavenlies, there are angelic hosts that are on the side of God's people, the great Archangel Michael, who is responsible for the protection of Israel, and the angel Gabriel in the heavenlies warring in behalf of the people. It's this reason why on the other side of chapter 11, chapter 12 reminds us of the certain outcome of it all. There is a book. Michael says, Gabriel says, God has a book of truth. He's going to read from us, from it, selective portions, which is what chapter 11 is. But the good news is that as difficult and puzzling as the adversities of this life are, they're all encompassed in the sovereign plan of God. Nothing is catching him by surprise. And indeed, the ultimate comfort is for those whose name is written in the book, found written in the book, they will be delivered and they will awake to everlasting life, we read in chapter 12. So then let's get into the hard news, beginning with chapter 11, verse 1. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him. I love that verse, even though it actually goes with what precedes. And here, maybe it's helpful to be reminded that the chapter divisions in the Bible are not part of the inspired Word of God. Daniel did not write his book with chapter divisions. These were invented in the 13th century AD and added in order to assist believers to find portions of the Bible when they're talking with one another. But oftentimes the divisions are misleading, and here they're terribly so. Chapters 10 to 12 are one sustained, continuous narrative. They all belong together, chapters 10 to 12. So we should disregard the divisions. And verse 1 then really is referring to a conversation that goes before in chapter 10. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I, that is the angel Gabriel that is speaking with Daniel, took my stand to support and protect him. What a wonderful lesson. From heaven's perspective, the world is divided between the kingdom of darkness and the kingdom of light. It's black or white, viewed through the lens of eternity and eternity's values. But here on earth, there's all kinds of gray. And even someone like the pagan king of an enemy power, a superpower like Persia, Darius the Mede himself, is benefiting from the ministrations of the angels. This man, who to our knowledge was not a believer, nevertheless was used in the economy of God to bless his people. I took my stand to support and protect him in that first year. That first year, by the way, was the year when Darius the Mede, who is also called Cyrus the Persian, was inspired, and now we realize really by the enablement, supernatural enablement of God and his angelic hosts, he was inspired to issue a decree that allowed Israel to return to the promised land. He even endowed the rebuilding of a temple in Jerusalem so God's people could worship the Lord. It so happens in 1879, archaeologists made an amazing discovery over in Babylon, where they were digging at the time, that confirms this decree and allowed modern scholars to recognize this was part of a comprehensive plan of Cyrus in allowing all the formerly captive peoples that the Babylonians had brought to distant lands in exile, all of them to return to their ancestral homes, and every one of them to rebuild the respective temples of their traditional faith. This amazing Cyrus Cylinder, as it's called, has been then dubbed the Charter of Human Rights. It, in fact, is the very first declaration of human rights for the freedom of religion. I mean, it really is astounding and tragically ironic that the modern nation of Iran that bequeathed to the modern world, to even the ancient world, this privilege, this charter of religious freedom, has withdrawn that freedom from its own people. But here it is, anyway, back in chapter 11, with the blessing of God. Then we move on in verse 2. Now, then I tell you the truth. Three more kings after Darius will appear in Persia, and then a fourth, who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. From the time of Jerome, these three kings have been identified convincingly as Cambyses, Smerdis, and then Darius the Great. We actually know who all the players are. In fact, right throughout virtually most of the chapter until we get to verse 40 anyway. And then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Well, this fourth king is almost certainly Xerxes, the king known to us as the husband of Esther, the queen, in the book of Esther. And ancient historians, Herodotus and others, confirm that he was fabulously wealthy, just like the text says. He's the one who launched the first attack against the people, the Greek peoples. At this time, this is before they became a unified nation. He was stopped at Smyrtis, but that's when the wars began between Persia and Greece. Then after verse 2, we go to verse 3, and we actually jump over 130 years and eight Persian kings who aren't even mentioned. Just skip right over them, because they're inconsequential for the purpose at hand. During their time, there was no great suffering for the people of Israel, as there had been in earlier period. And so they can be dismissed, and again, it's a selective report. But be aware of that there are these gaps. They ought to be there and recognized. We're not surprised. Then a mighty king will appear, who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of the heaven. And it will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. Who is this king? Well, Oliver Stone has blessed us with a 173-minute film on him. It's Alexander. And all scholars commenting on this chapter, no matter what their background, are in agreement. He's the one. Daniel has already emphasized his role in Daniel chapter 8. And the text tells us that this one king, that yes, when he died, his kingdom then was bequeathed not to his own descendants. He had a son who was born posthumously, but obviously as an infant wasn't capable of receiving the throne. And instead, the kingdom was divided among his four generals. Toward the four winds of the heavens, the successor kingdoms of the Greek world kingdom, the Hellenistic world kingdom. It's interesting that from the biblical perspective, Alexander rates one verse from Oliver Stone's perspective, 173 minutes. But that disproportion, you see, is a reflection of the principle of selectivity. Alexander's conquest of Israel was not actually of great consequence in terms of Israel's experience. Eventually, it meant that, of course, they spoke Greek. In fact, that's why the New Testament is written in Greek. But the suffering that comes later was not what was so featured with Alexander's conquest. He was actually only interested in proceeding on and taking the entire Persian Empire and then going out to India. As you know, Israel was hardly worth bothering with. Then verse 5, as we continue on, we read, starting with verse 5, the king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. Beginning in verse 5 to verse 20, we have 160 years being given a lot of attention. And it's a period of time in which Israel was experiencing life, as it were, in a vice grip. They were situated between two of those four successor empires that came from Alexander's conquest. They were in the no man's land in between. And the two powers then were constantly warring over the dog bone that was Israel in that no man's land. Their suffering was unspeakable at times because of this terrible situation. in the south refers to Egypt, and concentrated, centered in Egypt was then the kingdom, the successor kingdom, ruled by the Ptolemies. And in the north, in Syria, was the kingdom that was ruled by the successor general and kingdom of the Seleucids. And as we go through these verses, that's what it's all about. For 160 years, going back and forth, but more or less divided into two periods. The first period that takes us through verse 14 is when the south is dominant. The second period is when the north takes over, when the Seleucids take over. The king of the south will become strong, we read. Now, you say, why don't they give us his name? Well, actually, these kings all had the same name. The kings of the south and the southern kingdom were almost, well, all of them were, every one of them was named Ptolemy. You know, we add numbers, modern scholars add numbers, but it was Ptolemy, Ptolemy, Ptolemy. So you now just learn 14 kings' names. And in the north, all the kings likewise had either Seleucus as their name or Antiochus. And so it's not terribly imaginative, this naming process for parents, but it does make it easier for historians. Anyway, the king of the south will become strong. That's Ptolemy the first. But one of his commanders, and his here refers to Alexander mentioned in the previous verse, one of his commanders, that is Seleucus the first, will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. In verse 6, after some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance. There's a marriage alliance between these two competing successor kingdoms. But she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days, she will be handed over, together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supported her. In fact, we know from extra-biblical sources that they were all poisoned. Verse 7, one from her family line, this is in fact her brother, Ptolemy the Third, now, will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north, now Seleucus the Second, and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold and carry them off to Egypt. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but will retreat to his own country. His sons, this is referring now to Seleucus the Third and Antiochus the Great, as he would be later known as, will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. All of these events, if you aren't memorizing everything I'm saying, you can find them out for yourself in any study Bible. They'll always be included in the notes or any commentary. It's remarkable how much in agreement modern scholarship is in identifying all these players. You can't miss it. The details are so well fitted to the history that is reconstructed as well from other sources. In any case, in verse 11, then the king of the south, now Ptolemy the Fourth, will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north, now Antiochus the Great, as we mentioned, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. The ancient historian Polybius tells us, in fact, 17,000 lost their lives in that battle. Yet he will not remain triumphant. Verse 13, for the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. The violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. And here now begins the turning point as the power shifts from the south to the north under Antiochus the Great. Verse 15, then the king of the north, Antiochus the Great, will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist, even their best troops, and will not have the strength to stand. The invader, that's Antiochus, will do as he pleases. He is just so irresistible in his strength. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land. The name, the endearing name for Israel, found later in this chapter, also used by Daniel back in chapter 8. and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage. This is Cleopatra the first of seven Cleopatras. The one you and I tend to think of is number seven, the one who had a relationship with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. But here's her ancestress, Cleopatra I, in order to overthrow the kingdom, but his plans will not succeed or help him. So much for human plans. Verse 18, then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them, but a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back on him. Who's this mysterious commander? Well, everyone recognizes him as one of the Roman consuls, Scipio. It's now Rome's turn to begin to make its power felt on the distant horizon. And in fact, Scipio defeats Antiochus the Great and takes his son as a hostage to Rome to ensure future compliance with Rome's wishes. They're not yet ready to gobble up Israel and all the surrounding communities, but he takes the son of the king hostage for 15 years, a man who we later would know as Antiochus Epiphanes, the arch enemy of the people of God. We'll come back to him. But anyway, in the battle, he's lost. And after this, verse 19, he will turn back toward the fortresses of his own country, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more. His successor, Seleucus IV, will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or battle. All of these details we could talk about. There, make comments about, show ancient history parallels for, and confirm that this is, in fact, well, it's tomorrow's news being read today by the ancient readers. It is so detailed. Then starting in verses 21 to 39, we read about the fortunes of Antiochus Epiphanes, this arch enemy of God's people who began his career as the hostage for the victorious Romans, now come back to power. And in fact, the Bible leaves us no room to doubt what its estimate of him is. Verse 21, he will be succeeded by a contemptible person who will not be given the honor of royalty. He stole the throne. He was not the one who was in succession. He arranged for the convenient murders of those who would be possibly his contenders for the throne. The arch-villain marches on. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him, both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. Verse 23, after coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. In verse 24, when the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve that what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. He's on the move and has expansionist dreams. He saw Rome, and he is now bound and determined to forge alliances and create an empire that could withstand the seemingly relentless march of advance of the enemy. In verses 25, with a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage and go against the king of the south. He's going to gobble up Egypt. He's going to reforge the empire that Alexander made. The king of the south will wage war in a large and very powerful army, but he will not stand able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provision will try to destroy him. The army, that is Ptolemy's, will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other. Doesn't that sound like many modern-day roundtable discussions? Shows you nothing has changed. Anyway, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. You see how God keeps foiling the plans of the evildoer. There's an appointed time. It's only for a season. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. He's taking action against the Holy Covenant, the people of God. They are now in the crosshairs for his wrath. Having been stopped, at least momentarily, at Egypt, he's now going to unleash his wrath against Israel and against its faith. But he's not done yet. At this point, he's just plundering the temple for some wealth, silver and gold from the sacred vessels that will enable him to raise a larger army to do what he was stopped doing earlier. Verse 29, at the appointed time, he will invade the south again. But this time, the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart. The western coastlands here is, in Hebrew, Kittim, which is used in the Dead Sea Scrolls as a reference to Rome. These are ships from Rome. What we're talking about here is the Roman legate coming with his armies, who stopped, we know for a fact, stopped Antiochus Epiphanes in his expansionist dreams right there in Egypt. The legate came out of his boat, drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus Epiphanes, and told him that he could not step out of that circle on penalty of his life if he did not give in to the demands of Rome. And the demands, the ultimatum, was that he would stop any further expansion and go back home. Well, that's what he did, but he wasn't a graceful loser. Antiochus Epiphanes then takes it out on those who are back there in Israel. Back there in the homeland, newscasts were a little bit mixed up. They heard that Antiochus lost. Everyone was delighted to hear it. They jumped to the conclusion that he had actually lost his life. And so a rebellion surfaced in Jerusalem. Antiochus hears that his subjects have rebelled, and he decides, that's it, I've had it. The only reason they're rebelling is because of that Jewish faith. And so he was bound and determined to eradicate not the people, but their faith. This is the first time, really, in world history where you have that kind of diabolical motive for the eradication of, in this case, the true faith, much less any other faith. But here then Antiochus comes back. It says in verse 30, he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. No wonder so many verses in this chapter are given to Antiochus Epiphanes, about whom most of us know very little. No wonder so many verses, because of this malevolence, this demonically inspired loathing of the faith of the people of God, as he then responds. First, we read in verse 31, his armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Antiochus, when he defeated Jerusalem, went into the temple, and he went right into the Holy of Holies, desecrating it, the place where no one but the high priest was permitted to go. Not content with that, in verse 31, they will then set up an abomination that causes desolation. This happened in the 25th of Kislev in 167 BC, and it seems to refer to Antiochus' intention. What he did was desecrate the altar for sacrifice to God out in the court, the altar of burnt sacrifice. He put on top of it an altar to Zeus, and he offered swine as a sacrifice, the pig being sacred to the Greeks, but repugnant to faithful Jews, and an abomination in the eyes of God as an object for sacrifice in terms of the Old Testament law. No wonder the temple was so desecrated that in response, when at last the people of God were able to throw off Antiochus' oppression, when they rededicated the temple, that rededication is celebrated in Hanukkah. That's what Hanukkah is all about. The cleansing of the temple, Hanukkah meaning cleansing or rededication, the rededication of the temple after the defilement caused by this arch-villain Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, what are we to do about it? Let's go to the practical application, and next Sunday, Lord willing, we'll return to the even more engaging parts in some ways. But what should believers do in response? when you got an Antiochus Epiphanes breathing down on you a culture war like we're reading about in this text, when you're the object of such malevolence directed even against your faith, what is the response? Are we fight fire with fire? Are we to muster a larger army? Well, of course, the whole lesson of the previous verses is, you know, larger armies don't help. They just buy a few minutes until another larger army comes and wipes you out. There's always a bigger fish in the pond. Whoever lives by the sword dies by the sword, is the summary of Daniel chapter 11. No, instead, you conduct a spiritual warfare at a whole nother plane. And the weapon of your warfare, in Daniel's language, is called wisdom. In verse 32, with flattery he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. If you know God, and he's not just a theory, if you're Christianity is not just a religion, but a vital relationship with a personal God whom you know, the creator of the heavens and the earth, then you're not going to be fooled by a counterfeit, no matter what shape the counterfeit takes. You're not going to be fooled by Antiochus' megalomaniac claims to be God on earth. At this time, Antiochus was striking coins that he used throughout the realm that add to his name the name Epiphanes. That's his name for himself. That's the Greek word for the manifestation of the God. He's an epiphany of the God, he claimed. He's Zeus on earth. You've seen Antiochus, you've seen Zeus. He's seen me, has seen Zeus, is what Antiochus is claiming. On the coins would then be an image of the traditional Zeus in postures that were recognized. But you know what the smiling face was that was looking out at you? It was Antiochus' face superimposed on the idol of Zeus. He's claiming to be God on earth. With flattery, he'll corrupt those who have violated the covenant. He came in with enormous bribes. He's well known for having won over many of his opponents by greasing their palms, seducing many into compromise, making it clear to them there was no way of escape. And so many, we read, were corrupted. They violated the covenant by his flattery and his shenanigans. But if you know God, you will firmly resist him. It doesn't matter what the price is. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. In fact, those who resisted him, well, as a result, let's look at the outcome of a wise life in verse 33. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. Most people think if you're wise, you avoid junk like that. You find a way to kind of work the angles, to ingratiate yourself with the powers that be, flying below the radar. No, the wise in Daniel follow the wisdom that Daniel himself exhibits of having some starch in your life, of standing up against that which is opposed to God, even upon possible penalty of your life. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the blazing furnace. And as Nebuchadnezzar did so, they confessed, "The God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he doesn't, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." There's no guarantee that you and I will be blessed with the exact same outcome of deliverance from the blazing furnace or the lion's den that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and Daniel enjoyed. This text says, no, wisdom often ends with martyrdom, with rejection, if it's God's wisdom. What is that wisdom that allows that to happen? How is it wise, you say? Well, it's the outcome of it that proves its wisdom. Some of the wise, we read in verse 35, will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. Never mind what Antiochus has in mind. God has a plan that will overrule it. Meanwhile, yes, you may suffer greatly, but the result will be not your destruction, but your refinement. your purification, the making of spotless a people of God. The fire never destroys the gold. It only burns up the combustible impurities. It will do you no harm, those adversities that come, but only good if you receive them as from the hand of the Lord, as he burns away pride and self-confidence and drives you to a Savior that is sufficient for it all. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, James says, because you know that the trying of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. As Job says, he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I will come forth as gold. Job's sufferings were not the result of divine punishment, but God used them to purify him. Israel's sufferings in this whole period of time were not necessarily related to divine punishment corporately, but God used them to purify those who were wise and responded appropriately. What's the wise response? Some of us in the church have received emails from our partners in the Ukraine. One from a pastor from Kiev, Sergei Timchenko, who writes, "We continue enjoying great opportunities to share with many people the gospel and pray for them." Right in the center of Kiev, he and other members of his church are part of the camping group that's spending day and night there in the center. I'm amazed at how open people's hearts are in this situation. Pray for the unity of Ukraine and for the many people who are deceived by the official propaganda. Maybe the Ukrainians, he writes, feel like modern Daniels. Wonderful allusion. That just leapt off the screen at me. Then he quotes others involved in the ministry, the Christians for Truth, who are running a prayer center right in the center of the camping people of the Ukraine there in Kiev. Oleg Vasilevsky writes, quote, On a very separate note, I would like to ask you to pray for the churches in Ukraine. I'm probably going to get in trouble for typing this, but my heart is torn apart that the churches are still too often silent in their quest for justice. The first people to be in downtown Kiev demanding the transparent election process should have been the Christians. It doesn't matter what candidate we vote for. We should be hungry for justice and truth, despite which side we are on. The worst side to be on is the neutral side. The worst side to be on is the neutral side, writes Oleg, this leader in the church. For many years, we've preached that there was no golden middle. And by not taking sides, you take a side. But are we acting on this ourselves? Do we believe it? He writes. With flattery, Antiochus will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. With his smooth words, he makes it so plausible that you can get along if you just go along. But the people who know their God will firmly resist him. The encouragement that Daniel gives to us, you might wonder, is a strange kind of encouragement because it involves so much painful detail of the sufferings that were awaiting the returnees from captivity. Here's the history of tomorrow's news. Here's what we're going to face. One battle after another climaxed with this goon, this wicked, malevolent Antiochus. Why does the Bible tell these people these things? To paralyze them with fear? I've often been impressed with Dr. Henry Beecher, who was an army doctor serving at Anzio in World War II. In 1944, 100,000 Allied troops were stranded on the beaches of Anzio in a stalemate that went on for 4 months. 4,400 British and American soldiers lost their lives. 18,000 were wounded. And there was the army doctor, Henry Beecher, among them, serving the troops. He wrote about his experiences when he got back, and he talked about soldiers with deep lacerations, with broken bones, with entire limbs amputated by mortar fire, waving off with the other limb the invitation to receive a shot of morphine to control the pain. Dr. Beecher was a pain specialist, and when he came back to Mass General Hospital, he set up a cohort of other patients with similar wounds, lacerations, broken bones, accidental amputations, and measured their needs for pain relief in order to deal with this terrible affliction. And to his amazement, it was as if that their pain could not be controlled, while the soldiers at Anzio had no pain. And so he examined the three requirements for that ability to sustain that terrible adversity. And the first, he says, is conditioning. There was one difference. The soldiers are trained to expect pain. When you're dropped into the beach of Anzio, you know there's a war going on. It's the power of negative thinking that's working for you, so that when the grenades are going off, you're not taken by surprise. And so Daniel is blessing those who read his book by allowing them to know that they're being dropped into a war zone. A war zone not only in terms of the warring of superpowers at the human level, but even in the spiritual realms, as we are as well. Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith. You know, are we surprised that we have cancer? Are we surprised that we have temptations to infidelity in our marriages or whatever the problem is that is testing your faith? You got an enemy of your soul who's working full time to destroy you. It's the power of negative thinking, conditioning, that helps give us starch and courage to live upright and faithful lives. Secondly, congruence. You're not alone. In Mass General, the ambulance drives in a tragic victim of a car accident, and he looks around. He's the only one who just lost his leg. On the beaches of Anzio, in the midst of a war zone, we're all taking fire. But it's the case for Christians. It's the comfort of recognizing that you're not alone, so you don't have to wallow in self-pity. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. 1 Corinthians 10:13, and God is faithful. He won't let you be tested beyond what you can bear. Here's the promise. We're not alone. That's why we're in small groups, to be reminded that we're all in this together. And then thirdly and lastly, confidence, according to Beecher, was key. The circumstances of these terrible afflictions all gave it meaning. In some way, soldiers perceived that the loss of their sight or their leg or how much blood advanced the cause of the liberation of Europe. It's what allowed the progress of liberation to move from D-Day to V-Day. And so it is for us. I want to know the Christ and the power of his resurrection, the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. Paul writes, our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. It's all playing its part. Don't be afraid of what you're about to suffer, Jesus writes in Revelation 2. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you'll suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful, even to the point of death, and I'll give you the crown of life. And that's where Daniel 12 ends, with that promise of resurrection. In chapter 11, that nothing that is happening is outside the plan of God. We're all just getting a glimpse into his book of truth. His sovereign plan is working itself out, not only through weal, but also woe, through the sufferings of this life, because if we will bear the cross, we'll wear the crown. May God encourage us and strengthen us to live for him by this word. Let us pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for your word that is to us the foundation of our lives. May we be encouraged that those who are with us are more than those against us, and that you have promised us that everything that might happen in this life happens only according to your sovereign will and permission. We thank you that nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. We're more than conquerors through him. May it be so in his name. Amen.